Crosswires, navigating news with faith with Father Daniel Brandenburg, LC, and Chris McDonald. Crosswires, today's secular news stories viewed through a Catholic lens, from a layman's questions and a clergyman's reaction. Now, here's Chris and Father Daniel.
Nice to see you again, Father Daniel. You're back in studio, and I see you've brought yet another black eye. When are you going to stop these bar fights?
Wait a second. Another black eye. This is my first black eye in many, many years. And yes, it is a nasty cut and a black eye, but it was not a bar fight. You should see the other guy. Actually, you can't see him. No, I'm kidding. It was actually a soccer game. I played soccer for the first time in 10 years after cancer and neuropathy in my feet. I couldn't play soccer for many years. And then I was looking at my soccer cleats last Saturday morning, and I was like, hey, I should go and play. I don't know where that crazy idea came from, because I just had my 50th birthday as well. But I got out there on the field and was doing really well. And then on a header ball, a guy swung his arms, and his fist found my eye socket, and I lost on that one. So bled a lot, but finished the game, and then didn't need stitches. Thanks be to God.
Oh, I heard the counter punch knocked him out, so way to go.
No, I just called foul. I make sure our team got the ball. But
all right, so we've discussed from time to time the dire state of the Catholic Church in Germany, but we're going to move a little west into Belgium, where Johann Bonny, Bishop of Antwerp since 2009, who was known for taking progressive theological stances, said in a public letter to his parishioners that he would make every effort to ordain married men within the next 2 years to the priesthood. So as you know, bishops vow obedience to the Pope, and it's highly unusual for them to announce that they are considering an action that may contradict Catholic Church teaching. If Bonny went ahead and ordained married priests without the Vatican's permission, he would be possibly subject to excommunication. So I wanted to review the Church's teaching on priestly celibacy and where it stands in the larger scheme of things.
Mm-hmm.
The Church has what's called the Hierarchy of Truths, which you know about, which is the ranking of the order of the faith. And the hierarchy is as follows. You have at the top, you have dogma, and you have doctrine, then definitive teaching, then authoritative teaching, then theological opinion, and last, free opinion. So a dogma is a core doctrine that has been definitively proclaimed as revealed by God and must be believed. A doctrine is any official teaching of the Church. So all dogmas are doctrines, but not all doctrines are dogmas. Importantly, the Church can develop doctrine, meaning clarify and deepen understanding, but it cannot develop dogma, as it's believed to come from divine revelation, not human decision. So once it's declared, that's it. A discipline sits outside this hierarchy and refers to rules and practices the Church has the authority to set, change, or establish, or abolish. These are things that govern how Catholics are to worship. They are not themselves revealed truths. So, my question to you is, canon law currently requires priestly celibacy, and this is a discipline rather than a doctrine.
Correct.
And there are married priests that already exist within Catholicism, particularly in Eastern Catholic rites, and,
that's right,
and in specific cases of former Anglican clergy. So a practical rule like priestly celibacy can actually change, but some theologians are arguing that that celibacy has become so deeply connected to the theology of the priesthood, particularly the priest as configured to Christ, who was celibate, that it has taken on a quasi-doctrinal character. So where would you stand on this, and what do you think about this rising almost to the level where it is, in fact, doctrinal?
Well, I've been taking it out of the schemata of the dogma, doctrine, and discipline, and look at it from a practical standpoint and a relationship standpoint, because I think sometimes this can shed light on the situation. If I am in a relationship with Christ and with the Church, there's a commitment of total love and service to the Church that doesn't really allow for space for anyone else. And that's the nature of marriage, is you're committing to one woman, and you're going to love her, you're going to raise a family with her, you're going to be committed to her. So when a priest it takes on the vows of priestly service, he is committing himself to be married to the Church. The Church is literally his spouse, because he is in persona Christi. And so to open up the possibility of other relationships, another like a marriage, it is problematic just on a practical and relationship level. And then some of the best arguments that I've seen for priestly celibacy actually have come from Protestants, when I was studying classical humanities, we had to read a book by William Cobbett called A History of the Protestant Reformation in England and Ireland. And this gentleman, this historian, wrote this in the mid-1700s. And it was a book that was, he's a Protestant, he was an Anglican. He was writing and documenting what happened to the Episcopalian and Anglican churches when they allowed married clergy. A lot of unintended side effects that happened from that. Number one, the priests, now instead of the congregation having to support one person, they had to support an entire family. So there was an economic burden that the people didn't calculate on. A second thing that happened is that oftentimes these priests were now, because they had a family and a wife to protect, they were afraid to preach the gospel. They didn't want to get on the wrong side of the ruling parties. And so there was a fear and cowardice in actually preaching the truth, which was very detrimental to the church. We see that to this day in the Anglican church. Oftentimes politics and church get so woven together, there isn't a freedom of the church to preach the gospel. So these secondary effects are oftentimes forgotten by people when they start talking about, oh, priests should get married so we can avoid sexual abuse crisis. Well, that's a phony argument too. Because when you look at the incidences of sexual abuse, there's not a whole lot of difference between Protestant churches and the Catholic Church. In fact, in some Protestant churches, the rate of abuse is higher than in the Catholic Church. And then other people say, oh, but you know, we have a clergy crisis, shortage crisis, and if we had married clergy, then we'd have more priests. No, that's not the nature of the problem. You look at, in many places throughout Europe, Protestant churches who have married clergy have a shortage of clergy. This shortage of clergy is due to problems of the faith, not of the problem of celibacy. So I think it's important, Chris, to take into consideration all these other elements before we get into the just the schemata of, you know, dogma, doctrine, discipline. Because I, at least in all of my studies, yes, the it is a discipline when we talk about the nature of celibacy within the Catholic Church, recognizing that there are some married clergy in certain specific circumstances. But I'll never forget the testimony of one married priest here in the Archdiocese of Atlanta, who he was invited to this conference of kind of left-leaning group that wanted to promote the marriage of Catholic priests. And they asked his wife to speak about how great it was to be married to a priest. And she got up there, and the first thing she said was, I can't say this on the air as she said it exactly, but she said, oh no, that stinks. Mm-hmm. Because it's like my husband is constantly in a love affair with someone else.
Right.
So that's unfair to a woman who would be in that relationship. And I've talked with some married clergy who have come into the Catholic Church and they experience that. So there's lots of things we can talk about, Chris, here. I mean, my own experience of, you know, having lived as a celibate man for the last 33 years of my life, it's not easy, okay? There are challenges. There, just because you have a vow of celibacy or a vow of chastity does not mean that you don't, that women are not attractive anymore or you don't experience that.
Well, and so I'd like to,
attraction.
Yeah, I mean, that to me is one of the things that that doesn't get, or that you're talking about, like, I guess the point of this was that this could change. But there's the reasons why, what you're talking
right.
about. And one of the ones that you didn't mention, but I think you're about to, is that there is a certain, you know, there's that saying that there's the only people that you meet and respect without knowing them are a priest and a soldier.
Mm.
And for the priest, it's in large part because of this vow that they take.
It's a total commitment.
It's a total commitment. And the, you know, it gives a certain gravitas and standing to speak about things in moral matters just simply because of the vows that you take, and particularly the vow of celibacy.
Yeah, and it's really a statement to the world, because we believe so firmly in the power of Jesus Christ and the reality of eternal life that we are a living witness to the eternal truths. Because if we didn't really believe in it, we would just go live like everyone else.
Among those things, are you witnessing to the detachment to the flesh? By?
Yeah, totally. That's part of it. I mean, the vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience that I take as a religious, they're serious.
And those examples that you're providing for folks, that it can be done.
Exactly right. Yeah. I mean, of course, there are challenges. There are challenges in every walk of life. There's no vocation that is without a cross. But there's also great joys that come with the priesthood and with the vow of celibacy. There's a freedom that comes with it.
Crossed Wires.
If there's an aspect of this topic that wasn't addressed or you'd like further clarification, send it to crossedwires@thequestatlanta.com.
The Wall Street Journal reviews a book called The Laws of Thought, Network Thinking, and the Intellect. It's a book about how the human brain works.
Okay.
So the law of thought argues that human thinking is fundamentally network-based rather than operating through strict logic or linear reasoning. The mind works like a dynamic web of interconnected nodes, ideas, memories, and associations constantly linking and relinking, rather than the straight line thinking. So the brain behaves like a complex network, like social networks or the internet. So the key principles that are outlined are that association drives thinking. So ideas trigger other ideas.
Sure.
Small changes can have big effects. Like in network theory, minor inputs can cascade into major insights. Strength of connections matter. So frequently used connections become stronger and faster. Diversity enables creativity, so the more varied your experiences and knowledge, the richer your network. So cross-domain is better for thinking, like combining science with art.
Okay.
And then emergence over control. Thought is not centrally controlled. It emerges from interactions within the network. So this perspective encourages the messy thinking as a way to promote creativity rather than the step-by-step logic. So it challenges the idea of the purely rational top-down mind, and I like it. I mean, it kind of makes sense anecdotally the way, you know, anytime the rare time I've come up with a good idea has been, you know, often through this messy thinking process.
Sure. I think there's definitely something to it, and this is the fascinating thing when you start studying emerging areas in science, that they take data that we know from experience and think, oh, that makes sense. Now, I would couch this within a larger theory, which is that of the one of Thinking Fast, Thinking Slow, if you're familiar with that, by Daniel Kahneman. This book came out a number of years ago, and he addressed some of these same ideas, because we have this idea that all of our thinking is rational, but oftentimes it's not. He puts it as like there's two different ways of thinking. There's the rational, kind of slow, thinking it through way of thinking, so thinking slow, and then there's the thinking fast, which is more intuitive, more like this network thinking that you were describing, where it's like quick by association and emerging thoughts and the creativity. And it's perfectly possible that there are these two realms, and depending on the mode that we're in, we'll look at something more from a cautious, rational, thinking it through mode, which takes more time and energy, or just like a quick, you know, fly by the seat of my pants and shoot from the hip type of thinking.
Or if you're thinking of this, one of the things that was more interesting, like diving into this, is that, you know, if you're thinking about a math problem, maybe art can help you. You know,
definitely.
The other thing that jumped out to me is we often try to mimic nature and the things that we do in our material lives. You know, like airplanes with the little turned up tip of the wing that you see is a mimicking of birds that they figured out, you know, after they first started making airplanes. Well, this is sort of the opposite, right? We have our internet and our AI thinking and whatnot that's emerged here of late, mimicking what the human brain does.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're using that as their model,
sure,
right? Because it works.
Yeah, it does. Yeah, so it's fascinating to look at all these theories, and this is one of the beautiful things about our Catholic faith is we're open to truth from whatever direction it comes. And so if there's theories like this that shed new light on the amazing way that God has made the human mind and our interactions, awesome.
What do former NFL quarterback Philip Rivers, Hall of Fame Major League Baseball player Mike Piazza, and professional golfer Cam Young have in common?
They'll go to mass.
No matter what. If they have a sporting conflict on the weekend, they find a way to go to mass. Mm-hmm. So during the lead up to the annual Masters golf tournament in Augusta, Georgia, Cam Young was in a press conference and was asked about his final round of the 2026 Players Championship in Jacksonville, Florida, or near Jacksonville, Florida, and how the press had found out that he had gone to mass on the Sunday of his championship win.
Right.
And he said it was, he made it clear, this is not a one-time thing. He said, and he was with his family, by the way, his wife and kids traveled with him to that tournament. He said, wherever we are, we find mass to go. So I found his public.
That's a smart man.
Yeah, and I found the public testimonial to be quite, you know, refreshing and a great reminder to all of us dads out there, moms too, but particularly dads, you know, that maybe tried to prioritize their Sunday golf game, or I think even more often, their kids' travel ball sports.
Oh, gosh. Don't even get me started on that topic.
Yeah. So, you know, if Cam Young, who was in the final round pairing at the Masters, can find a way to make the attendance of Mass inviolable, you know, on the Sunday of Masters he went before he played, then there's no excuse for travel ball dads.
Anything, Dad? You're right. You're absolutely right. I mean, it's a question of priorities. We all have 24 hours in the day. What do we think that is most important? We're going to dedicate time to that. And if you don't value Mass, we'll find any excuse, any pretext not to go. And that's what it's unfortunate sometimes. And with, you know, travel or, you know, going to another place, you know, it's as if churches, Catholic churches didn't exist in other parts of the world. You know, you'd think that your home parish was the only place you can go. No.
You can always find a Mass.
You can always find a Mass. And actually, there's some great resources for that out there. CatholicMass.org. You can find Mass Times, MassTimes.org. Yeah. You can, you know, do a Google search, AI. It's really easy to find. And actually, I think it's really cool. If you're visiting another city, you kind of want to get to know the culture, the place, discover new things. Why not go and experience the cathedral of a different diocese, or go and find a church that has some, you know, historical element, or just, you know, worship together with other people.
Right, especially when you're traveling in another country. It's so cool go see how, you know, some of the differences. And, you know, it's the same Mass, but I remember going to a Mass in Hawaii where they had dancers come down the aisle, you know, wearing leis.
Yeah.
I'm not sure that was, you know, necessarily appropriate, but I thought it was cool. Another one that we went to in, I want to say, somewhere in the Caribbean, where I think it was in Creole, the language.
Really?
I've never heard this before, you know, so it's just neat.
It really is. It's beautiful to see that universality of the church. And, you know, and if we really, truly value something, we're going to make the time for it.
Crossed Wires. If there's an aspect of this topic that wasn't addressed or you'd like further clarification, send it to crossedwires@thequestatlanta.com.
Crosswires. A 25-year-old Spanish woman was euthanized last month by medical personnel on her request and with the approval of Spanish authorities. She was not terminally ill, but was approved for state-assisted suicide on the grounds of intolerable suffering. Her story is as follows. At age 13, her parents, who apparently had addiction issues, lost their home and they separated. Primarily because of the family's homelessness, Noelia Castillo was her name, became a ward of the state at age 14 and entered foster care. She struggled with mental health issues as a teenager and eventually was diagnosed as OCD and borderline personality disorder. As a teenager, she twice attempted to take her life, the second time after she was sexually assaulted. The second attempt was by jumping off a building, but she survived. She was badly injured and it left her paralyzed, and she also was now struck with chronic pain and neurological damage. In April 2024, Castillo formally requested euthanasia and was unanimously approved by the, this is the name of the organization or the agency, the Guarantee and Evaluation Commission of Catalonia. I'm not sure how they came up with that. Her father, with support of the Christian Lawyers Association, initiated legal appeals to halt the procedure. All courts rejected his request and upheld the daughter's right to die. The father argued his daughter could not make her own judgments due to her personality disorder. So after 600 plus days of legal battle, including all levels of the Spanish judiciary and eventually the European Court of Human Rights, they all agreed she had the right to die. Advocates for her case basically relied on the argument that assisted suicide is an expression of free autonomy. So I find Castillo's story a stark illustration of what happens when the family unit collapses and how poor the state is as a substitute for family. I mean, throughout history, right, through wars, famine, or pestilence, there have been countless children who have been orphaned. And the, you know, back then, and up until really only recently, the extended family network or religious institutions stepped in to care for them. Today, the state has replaced the village, and, you know, bureaucratic institutions like the one that she was placed in, they might be efficient at providing a bed and a meal, but what about familial love and continuity, et cetera? So, right. Thoughts?
Oh, gosh. We could take this in so many different ways, Chris, but it really is a tragedy, and we should pray for the repose of that poor girl's soul.
She's only 25.
Yeah, 25 years old and taking her own life and not seeing any hope or prospect for the future. And it's terrible that the state, you know, recognizing that she has these psychological disorders, would say that she's in her right mind to be able to say she's willing, you know, she wants to take her life.
Every level
of the
judiciary.
So many people regret that.
Everywhere. There was no pushback.
Yeah, it's a mindset. It's a mindset that doesn't respect the value of each human life, and it sees that any type of suffering is the worst evil. And I think that's a real problem, because it's antithetical to a Christian worldview, because Christ helps us to understand suffering, to make a point of suffering, that our suffering united with Christ can actually make a difference. You look at the lives of the saints who willingly embraced voluntary suffering, who would actually inflict sometimes suffering on themselves in order to be more closely united to Christ. And that brought them great joy and holiness and a perspective that lifted them beyond this world. And I think an anti-Christian worldview that is so wrapped up in self and an avoidance of suffering cannot see any value in suffering whatsoever.
Yeah, that's really, I think, what it comes down to, is that if you are certain that this is it, that you're right, that life ends when you
shorten
die,
all that suffering,
then, you know, then eliminating suffering might be the appropriate thing to do. But yeah, you know, what if you're wrong and you live eternally, whether it's eternally in heaven or eternally in hell?
Yep. Well, we know that they are wrong, and that gives a whole different perspective to what's going on here. So I think that's, we need to sometimes step out of the worldview that's in imprisoned us in many respects, and return to, okay, what's the real perspective? What's really going on here? There's a battle for every human soul, and we need to pray for her soul.
Crossed Wires. If there's an aspect of this topic that wasn't addressed, or you'd like further clarification, send it to crossedwires@thequestatlanta.com.
Crosswires. In February, the Chicago Bulls waived player Jaden Ivey after he posted a video on social media saying the NBA's Pride Month celebrates moral unrighteousness.
Mm.
Ivy has been outspoken about his opposition to the LGBTQ movement, and team staff members described him as preachy around the locker room. The Chicago
Bulls. Wait a second. This is an NBA player, right?
Yes. That's where we're going.
I don't watch the NBA or anything, but was he a good basketball player?
I don't even know, but...
Okay. Keep going.
So the Bulls' official statement was that he was released for conduct detrimental to the team. He maintains, Jaden does, that he was cut for expressing a viewpoint that cuts against the league's preferred messaging.
Mm-hmm.
The mental gymnastics and the follow-up to this have proven comical to me. So many high-profile NBA players and coaches openly advocate for various political causes, and the NBA itself aligns with certain movements such as Black Lives Matter, with BLM messaging on the courts.
Sure.
And the allowance of social justice jersey names,
mm-hmm,
as well as Pride Month branding. So their argument is that this is not a double standard, and it rests on pointing out that people like LeBron James, who's famous for his political stances, that he and others typically advocate for a group or a cause rather than condemning one, mm-hmm, which I find laughable, because LeBron has made statements criticizing the police, calling out Republican politicians by name, attacking Fox News and its viewers.
Right.
Former San Antonio Spurs coach Greg Popovich, who retired at the end of last season, one of the most celebrated coaches in NBA history, called Trump a soulless coward and repeatedly used his post-game press conference as a platform to deliver political lectures that had nothing to do with basketball.
Right.
Let's first ask, what do you think about sports leagues taking political stances?
Well, they're human beings in sports leagues, and so individuals are entitled to express their viewpoints. But there's always a certain amount of, you know, you don't want to alienate your fan base, and so the league itself or teams themselves try to curtail the outspokenness of their players in one direction or another. I mean,
they don't in the NBA. If it's part of the NBA's preferred messaging, they certainly
did in this case,
because it's not part of their preferred messaging.
Well, that's where the issue comes in. When you get an organization which is starting to choose sides And it's really no longer free speech. It's only speech in one direction. That, I think, becomes problematic.
Let's say the NBA made a concerted stance to advocate things like family values and the importance of religion.
Or
what then?
Fathers staying with their children and right, not abandoning their families.
What would you say to that?
Well, this goes back to a broader question. I think that we should all be having discussions about what really matters as a society. What's happening is we're getting these truncated conversations that are sound bites. And that's one of the things we're trying to avoid. Even as we do our show, Chris, we're talking about issues at a deeper level, challenging the reigning ideologies and saying, is this the best way to think about this issue? And I think as a society, we need to have discussions about what's right, what's wrong, what's better for our society. So instead of like just advocating for a position, let's think about the positions. Let's think about what actually will lead to the flourishing of our society, what leads to the truth, what leads to happy people, and not be afraid to challenge the status quo. That's the whole point of free speech. I mean, free speech is to allow us to dialogue about things, to argue, and to come to better ideas about the way that reality is.
Well, while I would love to see the NBA emphasize family values in their messaging,
that'd be awesome.
I think the broader point here is that it's a lack of recognition by various sports leagues and other entertainers as well, that that's what, in fact, they are, entertainers.
They
this
are.
Is mm-hmm. entertainment. And people do not want to be preached. They want to just unplug and relax and enjoy the spirit of a competitive ball game. They don't want to be preached to on either side, if I liked the messaging.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there's just this lack of, you know, we've talked about it before. What if your, you know, utility pole lineman was shouting down at you, you know, some political message about, you know, supporting clean air or something like that? You wouldn't, you know, why don't you do your job and just fix the, you know, the transformer, right? This is no different. They just have a platform and they feel compelled to use it.
They have a stronger platform. And I think that that's something people look at and say, oh, I want to use that platform. Now, when it gets co-opted by just one side of the political discussion, then that's problematic.
And when the league itself versus individual players. So, you know, the NBA is famous for their political messaging, whereas the Major League Baseball League is famously apolitical. And if you look at the height of the NBA, which was back in the late 90s, the number of viewers that watched the NBA Finals in 1998 was 29 million. Last year, 10 million.
Wow.
Major League Baseball, number of viewers in 1998 had 20 million viewers, and last year it dropped to just 16 million. So, you know, it's dropped in both, but one way more than the other.
That's right.
If there's a topic you'd like Father Daniel to address, send it to crossedwires@thequestatlanta.com.
Crosswires. Thanks for joining us. We'll be back again next week with a different take on the news.
This has been Crossed Wires, navigating news with faith, with Father Daniel Brandenburg, LC, and Chris McDonald. Today's secular news stories viewed through a Catholic lens on AM 1160, The Quest.